Good afternoon once again. This is Steve Krubiner, JSTOR's Chief of Staff in Washington. I'm going to be moderating the call today. We're very excited to have Barak Ravid on the phone with us to talk about the clear choice that Israelis will now have before them with the dissolution of the Knesset last week and elections scheduled on March 17th. Everyone knows there's a lot at stake in this election. While the two-state solution may not be the driving question of this election, the outcome will certainly affect the prospects for a two-state solution, which is one of the reasons that many of us are very tuned in to what's happening in Israel these days. Currently, the elections are considered to be what's called a change election, which means that the prime ministership is up for grabs, and there could be, as there always are in Israeli elections, dramatic twists and turns, like we've already seen in the past few days. I just want to make a plug that over the next 3 months, J Street plans to be a one-stop shop for election news and coverage, and we're very excited to announce a number of products to help all of you on the phone and in the J Street world follow what's going on. Our elections website, IsraelElection2015.org, goes live immediately following this call. That's IsraelElection2015.org. We're also premiering our new election bulletin, which is going to be an email roundup of breaking election news that will go out a few times a week. It will have the latest polls and top analysis in it, and you can sign up for that as well through the election website. Lastly, we're hoping to do a number of frequent briefing calls like the one that we're doing this afternoon in the lead-up to the March elections, and we'll be bringing top political analysts like Barak Ravid, as well as candidates in the election, onto calls as well. So with no further ado, I'd like to introduce our guest speaker for the day, Barak Ravid. Barak is a leading chronicler of all things political in Israel, and many of us depend on his Twitter feed for up-to-the-minute analysis and news. He is a diplomatic correspondent for Haaretz. He joined Haaretz in April 2007, covering the Prime Minister's office, the Foreign Ministry, and the Ministry of Defense, dealing with issues such as the U.S.-Israel relationship, EU-Israeli relations, and the peace process. Before Barak joined Haaretz, he worked for 2 years for the then-daily newspaper Ma'ariv. He spent a year covering the Palestinian Authority and a year as a diplomatic correspondent. Barak, before passing it over to you, I'd just like to ask that as you're speaking and referencing candidates, it would be particularly helpful to just indicate what party they belong to and to define any terms that are specifically related to the Israeli election system. What I'll do is I'm going to turn it over to Barak to start us off with a brief overview of the current landscape. And many of you have already sent questions into us, which I'll then ask him once he finishes with his initial remarks. If you still would like to send questions in, you can do so either through Twitter, through the Twitter handle at jstreet.org, .org spelled out, so J-S-T-R-E-E-T-D-O-T-O-R-G, or you can email info@jstreet.org. All right, Barak, over to you.
Hi, thanks everybody for tuning in. I'm going to start with, I think, something you guys might think maybe a bit over dramatic, and I hope I'm not going to, you're not going to come back to me in 4 months and say, oh, but you promised us that this is what's going to happen. But my personal analysis 4 months before the election, if we look at the big picture of this election, is to me it's pretty clear that the question is not who's going to form the new government, because this is still a question mark. But what I can say, at least in my opinion, what is more clear is who is not going to form the next government, and this person is Benjamin Netanyahu. I think that what we see in the last few weeks is sort of a trend in Israeli public opinion that says basically we want change, we want somebody else, we don't know who we want as the next prime minister, because there are so many parties and things are not really clear, because many people in Israel don't really know why we even got to those elections. But it's pretty clear that we don't want Netanyahu anymore. We don't want him anymore because We had it for the last 6 years. We don't want them, and, you know, and we want something new and fresh. Something that I guess you all feel from U.S. politics. I think that a lot of people in the U.S. feel that about President Obama. That okay, we had him for 6 years. Now we're ready to move on. For each person, for other reasons. And the same goes for Netanyahu. I think people are pretty fed up with social economic situation. The economy is getting worse. Israel's credit ratings have gone down. More unemployment. More factories are being closed down in the periphery areas, in the north and in the south. The cost of living is not getting any better. The cost of housing hasn't moved an inch, and all the big promises for reform didn't really happen. On the peace process, as you know, if anybody had any expectations in the last 2 years with this current government, he was disappointed because the peace process failed. There are many reasons for this failure, but one main reason is the fact that the current Israeli prime minister, at the end of the day, did not really want to really make any big compromises in order to make it happen. He was not the only one responsible, but he had a big share of the responsibility. And lastly, I think, most importantly, the security situation. Mr. Netanyahu, in the last 6 years, his ticket, not in the last 6 years, in his 25 years in politics, his ticket was always, I'm going to be the one to give you security. I will be strong against Iran. I will be strong against Hamas. I will be strong against Hezbollah. What happened, what we've seen in the last 6 months, is quite the contrary. Since the kidnapping of the three Israeli teenagers back in June, afterwards with the Gaza war, in the last few weeks, this intifada that is growing in East Jerusalem, in the last 6 months, there were something like 85 Israelis who were killed in terrorist operations, whether it was in the war in Gaza or in other places. And I think that this promise by Netanyahu that he will bring security, many people see it as not really valid anymore. So for all of those reasons, Netanyahu is in a very, very big problem, because people say, okay, we had enough, now let's move on. Saying that, it is still not very clear who is the alternative. Yesterday we had, as some of you might have heard, we had here quite a dramatic move by the chairman of the Labour Party, Mr. Yitzhak Herzog, and the chairwoman of the Tnu'ah party, Tzipi Livni, former Minister of Justice, former Minister of Foreign Affairs, former chief negotiator for Israel. Both of them announced that they are running together on a joint ticket that will call the name of the new list will be called the Zionist Camp. And they are running on a centrist platform with the announced goal of having a rotation agreement between them on the prime ministership, which means it might sound pretty crazy to all of you, because it's something that is not very, or I don't think that something like that is even possible in U.S. politics. But basically, their agreement is that Mr. Herzog will be prime minister for the first 2 years of the term, and then they will switch, and Mrs. Livni will be the prime minister in the next 2 years. While it is very, very hard to expect how this will be really implemented the day after the elections, it is a very new and bold political move that I think, change the political landscape for those elections. Because what it did was it brought for the first time in many, many years a real alternative for Mr. Netanyahu. If you look at the latest polls, you see that Mr. Netanyahu, let's say, 2 or 3 months ago in the polls, he got 27 seats in the Knesset. A month ago, he got something like 25, 24. 2 weeks ago, he got 22. And the last polls that were done yesterday, he got 20. On the other hand, if Tzipi Livni's party didn't even pass the threshold in a few months ago, and the Labour Party got something like 12 or 13 seats, both of them combined in the last few polls that were done in the last week showed that they are getting between 22 and 25 seats, thus beating the Likud, and having the opportunity to be the ones who get the first mandate from President Rivlin to try and form a coalition. They have another advantage. The other advantage they have is that if you look at the results of the polls that other parties get, they have a possibility with the ultra-Orthodox, with other centrist parties, and with other left parties and the backing from outside the coalition of the Arab MKs to even try and form a coalition of something like 62, 63 MKs, which is not a big coalition, but it's possible. So I think that for the first time in 6 years, there is a real chance to change the government in this country and to have a new prime minister, which is not Benjamin Netanyahu. I know that for some of you, or for most of you, it even sounds fictional, but it is a real possibility, and I think that we are in the best situation to change the government in this country that we've been. We're closer to this than we ever been in the last 6 years. So this is my short presentation, just to give you a quick overview, and I'm happy to answer your questions.
Thanks so much, Barak. I'm going to start out with a question from Judith Steinberg. Judith asked, with so much at stake, why are some commentators saying they expect a very low voter turnout?
Well, I think that one of the problems with those elections is that we just had elections a little less than 2 years ago. And it's not that every time in Israel we have an election every 4 years. It's true that the average is election every 3 years. But still, this is, you know, to go for elections after 1 year and 9 months, and the fact that, you know, new elections cost something like 2 billion shekels. So people ask themselves, why do we even bother? Why do we even go and vote when those politicians just, you know, they spend their tax money and just in order to boost their egos, and then instead of trying to solve the problems, they just go for another election because they can't get along. So I think that many people have this feeling of disgust from politics, from the Knesset, and from the whole political process. And this is a big challenge and even a threat for Israeli democracy, because the percentage of people who are voting is going down in the last few years. You can see similar trends in the U.S. And around the world, because people are, let's say, disenchanted from politicians, from politics. And I think that this time the challenge will be how to bring voters to the ballots, to the the polling stations, and at least in my opinion, if when I try and assess the situation, the higher the voting percentage is, the bigger the chance that Mr. Netanyahu will not be the next prime minister.
Barak, in the United States, we have a lot of get-out-the-vote efforts. Is that something that you've seen in previous Israeli elections, and is it something you expect to see in this election?
Well, every time at the beginning of the, at least in the last three or four election campaigns, in the beginning of the campaign, which means, I don't know, 3 months, 4 months before the elections, the press and NGOs start those campaigns, get out and vote, etc., etc., and celebrities are going on the air and the radio and on television and telling people go out and vote. The problem is that usually it doesn't really help. What can help is if the parties who actually need those votes will be able to mobilize people and to give them the feeling that those elections really matter and that their votes really count. This is the big challenge, and especially for the Israeli left. If the Israeli left will be able to give the to give the people the feeling that change can happen, then I think that the numbers of the voters will be much higher. I'll give you an example. A city like Tel Aviv, who is, I think, in a very broad assessment, is the vast majority of people living in Tel Aviv vote center-center-left. But the problem is that the percentage of voting is something like 55%, 60% on a good day. If the percentage was closer to 70%, that's another one or two seats in the Knesset for center-left parties. So the challenge is to get for the left-wing or left or center-left parties. The challenge is to create this momentum and this excitement that get people out of their homes and to the voting and to the ballots.
Do you see a threat with better voter turnout of turning out more votes for Naftali Bennett from the Jewish Home?
Well, it's a very good question. Let's in order to answer that, let's try and think who are the people who are going to vote Likud in the next election? What's the profile of the Likud voter? If you are let's say national religious right wing, you're not going to vote Likud, right? You're going to vote Naftali Bennett. If you are let's say a 50 plus years old Sephardi Israeli Jew, you would vote for Moshe Kahlon, the former minister from Likud who left the party and formed his new party. If you are an Israeli of Russian origin, you would vote Lieberman, Avigdor Lieberman, the foreign minister that has his own party. So this is the big problem that Likud has. And if you ask me where are all those votes going to, most of them go to Naftali Bennett, the head of the Jewish Home, a Beit HaYehudi party, the extreme right wing party that opposes a two-state solution, supports what it calls one-state solution, what I call an apartheid state, and it's quite amazing that because what Naftali Bennett managed to do, which this is the challenge for the center-left in this country, what Naftali Bennett managed to do is to create a lot of excitement and to mobilize people who are, some of them, center in the center of the political map. They are not right wing. They are not extreme right. But you know, they feel, they see him. He's a fresh candidate. He's young. He creates excitement, and he manages to get a lot of the voters who vote either Likud, either Lieberman, either Yair Lapid, and to get those people who are, some of them, not religious, not nationalistic, not right-wing, you know, secular, centrist people from Tel Aviv that go and vote for him. On the one hand, this is sort of a challenge because he can be, in the next election, he can get more seats in the Knesset than Likud. Likud can get, with the current trend, Likud can go down to 17, 18 seats. Naftali Bennett has the opposite trend. He's going up. He can get 20, 22 seats. So on the one hand, you know, I guess all of you might think, oh my God, Naftali Bennett with 20, 22 seats, he might be the prime minister. And he might. There is such a possibility. We can never rule that out. This is a scenario that you all need to think that could happen. But there is also a positive side to it. If this will be the case, and Naftali Bennett will get 22, and Likud will get 17, 18, this means that the right wing will not win the next election. The reasons for that is that Naftali Bennett might be the biggest party on the right, but he will be unable to form a coalition. I remind you that this is that the system of government in this country is a parliamentary one, which means that people need to form coalitions, and you need to get people to agree to sit under you in a government. And Naftali Bennett has very big problems with many parties. For example, the ultra-Orthodox, because he is a national religious, the ultra-Orthodox will not be very quick to sit with him. They have a lot of ideological rivalries and a lot of personal rivalries, especially about religious issues that I'm not sure that they can overcome. Lieberman, I'm not sure will agree to have Bennett as prime minister, because if he agrees to that, he basically, what it means, that he says that Bennett is the next leader of the right. Obviously, people like Yair Lapid and Herzog and Livni will not agree to sit under Naftali Bennett in the government, so he will have a hard time forming a government, which means that the left might get the chance to do it instead of him. So Bennett's rise is also a challenge, but it's also an opportunity.
Thanks, Barak. Naomi Heller asked a question, which is, can you explain why Amos Oz and other liberal Israelis encouraged Belgium to recognize a Palestinian state? And I want to just expand on it. We've seen a number of there are a number of international steps that are sort of taking place across Europe with unilateral recognitions, but also with a potential approach by the Palestinians with the UN Security Council resolution before Christmas, and also the French UN Security Council resolution that is being discussed. How do you think all of these international moves will impact, if at all, the Israeli election? Do you think that they play into Bibi's hand or into other players, and what impact does the U.S. role have around all of that?
Well, first, about the first question about Amos Oz and the other Israelis who signed this letter to encourage countries to recognize Palestine, you know, I just don't think it matters so much. It's most of those, what we hear in the news, that this country or another country recognized Palestine, I don't know how many of you are aware, the only country that actually recognized Palestine in the last few weeks or months is Sweden. In all the other European countries, it's parliaments who vote on motions to call upon their governments to do it. The only way to really recognize a country is if the government does it, not the parliament. So most of those are basically symbolic, and at least I don't see them as that important. I mean, I don't know, they give the Palestinians some moral support, but I just think it's meaningless. But the bigger issue here is what's going on in the Security Council. A few months ago, the Palestinians announced that they will draft a Security Council resolution that will set a timetable for ending the occupation of the West Bank and East Jerusalem. They actually did that with the support of the Arab League and with the help of Jordan, and they put a draft text, circulated it in New York to all the Security Council members. This draft text says that the occupation must end until November 2016, and that the future Palestinian state needs to be based on the 1967 lines, with East Jerusalem as its capital. There's a lot of other parts to this draft, but those were the main things. What happened in the last few weeks, and all of that happened before we even knew we were going to have elections here. What also happened a few weeks ago before we knew we were going to have election is that the French government, in order to try and put forward a more reasonable text, decided to start draft another resolution that will replace the Palestinian one and will be, let's say, more balanced. The French decided that their resolution will say that the timetable will set a timetable of 2 years for ending, for reaching a final status agreement between Israel and the Palestinians, rather than actually ending the occupation, which basically is a more, let's say, reasonable timetable. But you know that this didn't really matter to the current Israeli government that rejected both drafts basically out of hand. But once we had those elections here, everything got much, much, much more complicated. Because think about it. A, the current government, the prime minister, the foreign minister, don't really have any time or attention to give this issue, even though it can be a huge diplomatic crisis. They just, you know, they are involved totally. They're consumed totally by the political agenda. On the other hand, because they are so consumed in the political agenda, any reaction or any policy that they will try to form will be totally politicized and will be politically driven, even more than on a regular basis. This raises concerns that the government might do very rash and even dangerous moves in reaction to this initiative by the Palestinians in the UN. The big question mark right now is the United States, because at the moment the United States does not really have any strategy on how to deal with this looming diplomatic crisis in the UN. The main strategy right now, if you ask John Kerry or people at the White House, you'll hear that basically what they're trying to do is to buy more time, to try and convince the French to wait until after a new government is formed in Israel, and to try and push the Palestinians more in order for them to postpone their move, even if not until the Israeli election, so at least in a few weeks, in hope that, I don't know, some miracle will happen. The U.S. is in another problem. The Obama administration, if there's one thing it doesn't want to do, is to veto a resolution on the Palestinian issue. The reason for this is that the Obama administration is invested in this anti-ISIS coalition in Iraq and in Syria with many Arab countries that will not feel very good about the U.S. Vetoing a resolution on the Palestinian issue. On the other hand, the administration doesn't want to get into a situation that it will not veto such a resolution from the fear that it will serve Netanyahu's politics. Because if the U.S., let's say if President Obama decides not to veto, the next thing that Netanyahu would do is use it in his own election campaign to say, oh, look, those anti-Semitic Obama is once again throwing Israel under the bus. He's trying to divide Jerusalem. I will be the one, this is what he will tell the Israeli voters, I will be the one who will save our capital from being divided. And in every election campaign, this slogan of this guy will divide Jerusalem, or I will be the one who will save Jerusalem, or will keep Jerusalem safe, was very, very effective. This is why both, for example, both Livni and Herzog are trying to be as centrist as they can and not be too much affiliated with, let's say, with left-wing platforms. This is why they're trying to attack Bibi more and more on social economic issues and on the issue of Israel's international isolation, the relations with the U.S., things that are more, let's say, consensual. And I think that this issue of this looming diplomatic crisis in the UN, this crisis will not be avoidable, and I think that in a few weeks, maybe even before New Year's, before Christmas, it will come to a vote in the UN. There's a good chance it will happen, and if this will be the case, I think that the White House will be faced with a huge dilemma on where it should go.
All right, thanks, Barak. I want to turn now to questions on demographics. Do you expect any difference in voting by gender or age, as there often is in the U.S.? And this is a question from Ken Silk.
If you can just repeat the question, please.
Yeah, do you expect that there's going to be a difference in how people vote based on gender or age?
It is still very, very hard to know, because the problem, as I said in previous question, the problem is not, at least in this election, the problem is still not demographics as it is the voter turnout. Because when you have an election with 55 or 60% turnout, it means that huge parts of the Israeli society did not go and vote. If, let's say, the Arab Israelis, only 40 or 50% of them go and vote, it means that if let's say, another 10 or another 20% will go and vote, this can change the whole political map. But I think that, at least from the last polls that were taken by Herzog and Livni, before they decided to go together in this political alignment, they say that the combination between them is bringing 30% more women to vote for this center-left party or list. It brings more young people, and it also brings some people who never voted for the Labour Party in their lives. So if this might be a sort of an answer on the issue of demographics.
Thanks. That's a great segue into other questions around the Arab-Israeli vote. So, one question is, can you explain, I'm going to combine a few questions from Richard Mobjish, Sam Bressler, and Howard Sumka. So the first question I want to ask is, can you explain the talk around the three Arab parties joining under one ticket and why they would want to or need to do that?
Well, first, one of the bills that passed in the last in the previous Knesset was a bill that raised the threshold for that the party needs in order to get into the Knesset. And it means that in order to get to the Knesset, the party needs to get at least the number of votes that will get it at least four seats in the Knesset. This means that some of the Arab Israeli parties that today get between three to four seats were under threat of extinction. So the only solution for those parties was to try and unite. The problem is that between the different three Arab-Israeli parties in the Knesset today, the ideological differences are quite big. You have one party that is called Hadash, which is a party that is based on Arab and Jewish cooperation. You have Arabs and Jews in the same party. Another party, which is called Balad, is basically an ultra-right-wing Arab-Israeli party. It's nationalistic. It calls for basically changing the whole identity of the state of Israel. And the third party is an Islamic party. So try and put those three together, it's quite a challenge. This is why, at least until now, those three parties have not managed to put together a platform they can all unite around. So at least the trend right now is that there will be two different Arab parties, one that will the Hadash party will stay as it is, maybe with some other small factions that will join it, and it will be again an Arab-Jewish party. And another, and the second party will be a combination or a united party between the Islamic party and Balad, this nationalistic party, which is again quite a strange creation, putting together political Islam and Arab nationalism. It didn't really work in any other place in the Middle East, but maybe like many other things, Israel will be a startup nation on this one too.
Barak, do you think that if there is that combination, that would increase Arab voter turnout, and how do you predict that where the Arab vote will go this election?
I think it will. I think we will see more Arab Israelis going to vote this time, but not a lot more. I think that the potential will still be much higher than the actual voting, which is a pity, And I think that I think that the biggest mistake, especially for center-left parties in this country, is the fact that they're not even trying to get votes from the Arab-Israeli constituency. I think that they're basically saying there's no use even trying, and by that they're, I think, missing a lot, because if parties like Meretz or the Labour Party would do more with the Arab public, not only before elections, but between election campaigns too, it would be nice. I think it can have a real effect on the political map.
All right, thanks. Now shifting to the American Jewish community, I have a question from Joy Hill, which is, what influence do you see the American Jewish community, and particularly American Jewish institutions, having on Israeli elections, if any? And do you think that that could change whatsoever the election results?
Look, I say it many times in lectures I give to young American Jews who come here for Birthright or for other programs, which it's something that I think to me, every time I say it, it just makes me a little bit more depressed. Although I'm not sure that that it will be relevant to most of the people on this phone call. I was glad to find that out in one of the J Street conferences that I was invited to, and met the quite amazing young generation of J Street supporters. But for many young American Jews, when they come, and it happens with young American Jews, and it's even a bigger problem with middle-aged people or older people, that they land in Ben Gurion Airport, they rent a locker, they open it, they check in their values, they close the locker, they go around Israel for, I don't know, a week or two or 3-4 weeks, they're having fun. They go back to Ben Gurion Airport, open the locker, check out their values, go back home. And this is one of the problems of the relationship between the Jewish community in the U.S. and the State of Israel. Many things that happened with in the last Knesset, in the last government, are things that would never fly in the U.S. The vast majority of American Jews vote Democrat. Vast majority of American Jews are liberal, but still, for many of them, when it comes to Israel, they will say, oh, no, but this is different. In Israel, it is different, and they are able to consume and to contain a lot of things that they would never, never, never accept if it would happen in their city, in their town, in their government. And I think this is one of the biggest problems in the relationship between Israel and the Jewish community in the U.S., that even after 65 years, more than 65 years, that the State of Israel is after the State of Israel was formed, still the dialogue and the relationship haven't matured enough to the point that that American Jews feel that they can be critical of, not of everything, but of the same things that they would criticize in their own country, especially on things that, you know, we all talk about many times about the U.S.-Israeli relationship, about shared interests and shared values. Shared interests, I think that there are many shared interests that are still valid. On the issue of the values, I have to tell you that with many politicians in the previous Israeli Knesset, I'm not sure that the slogan about shared values is really valid. And unfortunately, from time to time, you hear statements from ADL, from the AJC, from other organizations that raise concerns or even condemn, you know, if things are really in the most extreme cases. But in most cases, nobody says anything because people say, oh, no, in Israel it's different. And I think that if the dialogue will be more open, more sincere, and more mature, it will only make Israel better.
Thanks, Barak. As you know, a lot of the, and mentioned, which I appreciate, a lot of the folks involved in J Street are here because we want to give voice to our values, and we want to make sure that Israel is a country that not only lives up to the values that it was established upon, but also the values that we in the American Jewish community hold very dear. So one of the questions that I have, which is from Jack Greenblatt, is, in giving voice to our values, do you think that we should urge President Obama to speak out before the elections, or should we wait until after the elections around two-state issues? And I will just add, in particular, on the UN.
I don't think that I'm one of those who think that at the current timing, the U.S. should avoid from doing anything active before the election. It should not do things that needs to be done. Okay, for example, it should not stop criticizing settlements because, you know, it did that before the elections. It will do it after the elections. It can do it during the election. It should not refrain from saying what it thinks about other issues, but to go on a new peace initiative or to put forward a peace plan or to even give a speech that will lay out President Obama's vision about the two-state solution, I think that right now the only thing he would do is give more ammunition to Prime Minister Netanyahu to say, oh, look, this is exactly what I told you. It's this current U.S. administration which tries to throw Israel under the bus, and by that to help Livni and Herzog to beat me in the elections. And this is the last thing I think that the White House wants to do, and this is why I just don't think that any such initiative will happen. I think that we should think about the day after the election, because if like I'm assessing, there will be a new prime minister, which will not be Benjamin Netanyahu, it means that there might be a need to try and relaunch the peace process. If Netanyahu will stay the prime minister, and there is a chance that this might happen, then it might be the time to think about new ideas on how to move things forward, or at least make it clear to the Israeli public, to the Israeli government, to the whole world, what the U.S. thinks should be the vision for a two-state solution.
And one last question on the American role. What role do you see someone like Sheldon Adelson playing in the Israeli elections? This is a question from Stephen Tenser.
Wow, that's a big one. Sheldon Adelson is, if you thought he was a big player in the U.S. presidential elections when he put in $100 million in order to kick Obama out of the White House, then relatively here in Israel he does much, much more. So he doesn't give, it's not the same system here. You cannot just give any amount of money you want to a political candidate because there's legislation that prevents that. But what he did is that he just decided to give the same amounts of money, but in a more creative way. A few years ago, he established a newspaper which is being distributed for free in this country, and became the newspaper with the biggest circulation in the country. It calls the newspaper is called Israel Hayom, Israel Today. And here in Israel, many people call it the Bibi paper. And this paper is distributed every day in something like 400,000, 450,000. On the weekend, something like a million copies. And it is all being circulated for free, not only in supermarkets or in train stations like in the U.S., but in many cases, they send it for free to your door. And every day, especially in election time, think about it, this is a more or less of a party pamphlet that its sole purpose is to keep Bibi as the prime minister. So I think that the importance of Sheldon Adelson in this, not only in this election, in the previous one, in the one before, and in everyday politics in this country, his influence is huge. One of the things that many people say pushed Netanyahu to go for an early election was the fact that enough MKs in the Knesset that realized that Sheldon Adelson is very dangerous, and that the Israel Hayom newspaper is a threat, decided to promote a bill that will prevent people from establishing newspapers that will be circulated for free. It's a very disturbing a bill because, at least in my opinion, it harms freedom of the press in a very dangerous way. Many people, even though many people on the left and many people who describe themselves as liberals say that in this case it's a completely valid legislation because of the huge influence, external influence that Mr. Adelson has on Israeli politics, and the fact that basically this is not a real newspaper, but a party pamphlet that its sole purpose is to promote Netanyahu.
Thanks, Barak. One last question, and then I'd love to ask you for your final thoughts. But the last question revolves around two different segments. One is it's from Barbara Goldman, which is, what will be the impact of the Orthodox right on the election? And the other question is from Karen Pliskin, which is, what is being done to engage the Russian Olim by the center-left?
The Orthodox right, I guess it means the... Jess, if you can tell me if you mean the Haredim, the ultra-Orthodox, or the national religious?
Why don't we talk about the ultra-Orthodox?
Oh, the ultra-Orthodox. So first, the ultra-Orthodox are not a monolithic bloc, and I'm not sure we can describe all of them as right-wing. The ultra-Orthodox have many issues that are important to them that have nothing to do with the Palestinian issue, with foreign affairs, with security issues. Their first and foremost is their institutions, their educational system, the yeshivas, and the budgets they get for their institutions. And other issues, like for example the draft bill, the new draft bill that passed in the last Knesset, and lowered and that basically will force ultra-Orthodox at some age to serve in the army, so to join the workforce, and many many other issues that have nothing to do with let's say with classic left-right issues. So the ultra-Orthodox in the next elections, especially because they are also much more fragmented than they've been in previous election campaigns, I think that even though many people are saying that they already have a deal with Netanyahu to support them the day after the election, I think that they are pretty much up for grabs for anybody who gets enough seats in the elections to try and get them on board on his coalition. So on that, I think it is much more open than it's been in previous election campaigns, which is another sign for the fact that that the results of those elections and that the next government can be very different than the current one. What was the second question?
The second question was on the Russian vote and what's being done by the center. And is the center left doing anything to win the Russian vote?
I think that one of the problems that a person like Avigdor Lieberman has is that there's no such thing anymore as a Russian vote, or it used to be much more prominent. But what happened is that the second generation of Russian of Jewish immigrants from the former Soviet Union, and today even have almost third generation, are much more Israeli than their parents or than their grandparents. So they are divided politically more or less like other parts of the Israeli society. So you can find Russian Jews or Russian Israelis, whatever you want to call them, in almost every party in Israel. And some of them, you don't even know that their parents or their grandparents immigrated here from Russia or from the former Soviet Union. So I think that while there is still a constituency of classic Russian voters that will vote Lieberman, this group is diminishing, and more sons and grandsons of and granddaughters of Russian immigrants are just becoming like the average Israeli and vote accordingly.
Thanks, Barak. Before we close the call, do you have any final comments?
I would just hope that that all of you guys will keep on following those elections. I think it's a very, 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 you know, we always say that it's a critical election campaign, critical year, sense of urgency, all of those slogans, but this time I think that it might actually be true and not just slogans. And I think it's going to be a fascinating election campaign because really everything is open. Everything is open. The polls show that that it's really we're only in the first or at the beginning of the second inning here, and everything is open. And I think things will be very close until the end. And like every good baseball game, things will be determined in the bottom of the ninth. So we'll just have to wait and see what will happen on March 17th.
Thank you, Barak Ravid. Always insightful to hear from you, and really appreciate this analysis today and over the next 3 months. As you know, we'll be following you closely. I just want to remind everybody to register for the J Street Conference. About 20% of those on the call are already registered. Let's try to get the other 80% registered as soon as possible. This is going to be the first national gathering of pro-Israel Americans after these March elections, so you're going to get great up-to-the-minute analysis. And I also just want to remind everyone that you can follow election news on our website. It's IsraelElection2015.org. That's Israel singular, election singular, 2015.org, IsraelElection.org. Thank you so much, Barak, thanks again, and thanks to everybody who sent questions in.
Thank you.
We will look forward to talking to you on the next call. Have a good afternoon.